It was the summer of 1979 when the idea of going on a camping trip first came up in conversation. Mark, a close friend of mine since high school, had been griping about his job for weeks. He'd been working some soul-crushing desk gig at an insurance company, and our mutual friend Joey and I weren't much better off either. I was bouncing between temp jobs and Joey was stuck in a warehouse moving boxes for minimum wage. We wanted to get away from things so bad. Anything to break up the monotony of either working or hanging out, but we didn't have the money to go jet-setting to the Bahamas, and we couldn't all get the time off for an extended road trip. And so instead, we decided to go camping. After a little discussion, we decided that the Harold Parker State Forest should be the spot. With it being just an hour's drive north of Cambridge, it was close enough to home that it made for an easy journey, but far enough and large enough to make it feel like a real escape out to the wilderness. When I say it's big, I mean it's big. It's over 3,000 acres of pine and oak and takes about 6 or 7 hours to walk across on a good day. We knew 'cause we'd been there once before, a day trip a few years back, so we figured 3 nights in early fall would be just right before the weather turned too cold and too wet. We started planning in more detail once the date got closer, pooling our resources to keep our costs down. My old rusted blue hatchback barely passed inspection, but it'd do for the trip to the forest, while Mark managed to dig out his dad's ancient two-man tent from his garage. It was still in decent shape despite a few patched-up holes, but since it only fit two, Joey brought along a little one-person deal that he'd bought cheap at an Army-Navy store. We split the rest of the gear, sleeping bags, a cooler, and some cool cooking stuff, and Joey tossed in a fishing rod, and I grabbed a couple of tarps in case it rained. Mark got a hold of a map of the park, one of those foldable pamphlet things that you can still get from the park's welcome center, and then after that, we figured that we were all set. I remember the drive being a lot of fun going up. We left on a Friday afternoon. The sun was still high in the sky as we blasted going up country and Born to Be Wild on the car stereo. And then about an hour later, we rolled into the forest just as dusk started to settle. The gravel lot near the entrance only had one other car parked in it, and after putting a few bucks in an envelope at the small wooden self-service kiosk, we picked a campsite near a place called Berry Pond. It was a flat clearing, surrounded by tall trees, with a fire ring already set up. The ground was blanketed in needles, and through the trees, maybe 50 yards off, the waters of the pond was shimmering in the light of that setting sun. It was beautiful, thinking back on it. We unloaded the car, hauled our stuff over to the site, and then got to work setting up camp. That first night was great. Mark got a fire going with a lighter and some crumpled up newspaper he'd brought, and then we cooked the hot dogs on a stick and heated the beans in a dented pot that I'd found in my mom's basement. The food wasn't exactly gourmet, but out there it was tasting better than I expected it to. When we were done with the dogs, we cracked the beers and then sat on the log that we dragged over to the fire. I leaned forward, just kind of staring at the flames, and felt the stress melting away from me as I thought, this is exactly what I needed. The next day, we decided to do some exploring, and so we picked a 3-mile trail that looped around the pond and up to an overlook. The path was narrow, and the woods were alive with the sounds of leaves rustling overhead and squirrels and animals darting through the underbrush. And the view from the overlook was well worth the hike, though, with the forest stretching out before us under the morning sun. And we sat there for a while, passing around a bag of trail mix and kind of dumbstruck by how beautiful everything was. It was all just so peaceful, and as much as the forest appeared wild and untamed, we felt safe. But we were wrong to feel that way. Sunday started just the same. We hiked again, a longer trail this time, and then got back to camp in the late afternoon, tired but very satisfied. Mark napped in the tent as I gathered more wood, then after eating while the sun was setting, we figured that we had to sleep early since we were so beat from the day's hike. With Joey's tent just this dark lump nearby, I zipped up our own, and then as I got into my sleeping bag, Mark was already snoring beside me. The forest went quiet, just the occasional sound of an animal, and then I drifted off to sleep. but I remember waking up cold. The air in the tent felt wrong, damp and cold. I fumbled for my flashlight, clicked it on, and saw the flap was unzipped. I sat up and shone the light around. Mark's sleeping bag was empty and his boots were gone, but his jacket was still there, wadded up in the corner of the tent. I checked my watch and it was just after 4:30 a.m., so I figured he'd gone to take a piss somewhere and would be back any second. I lay back down and waited a minute, but there was nothing but silence. Another minute went by and there was no whistling, no footsteps, nothing. After another minute, I sat up again, clicking my flashlight back on as I shuffled towards the flap of our tent and peeked outside. It was pitch black out there. The darkness was just swallowing up the beam of my flashlight as I scanned for any sign of Mark. I moved it one way, then another, but there was no trace of him anywhere. I felt kind of silly as I climbed out of my sleeping bag. Something like, was I really that much of a sissy that I'd given myself the creeps over nothing more than a friend going to the bathroom? And as I put on my boots, I figured that I'd probably get no more than 10 feet before I'd spot Mark returning, and I'd have to explain what a little scaredy cat that I was, getting the willies over him going wee-wee. But this other voice in my head kept speaking over the others, asking, "But what if you don't? What if he's in trouble?" And after pulling on my jacket, I climbed out of the tent and stood up and turned around in a circle with my flashlight in my hand. I was ready to see him walking back, but when I didn't, I took a few footsteps before calling out Mark's name. Kind of low at first, so as not to wake Joey unless it was absolutely necessary. And I circled the campsite, shining the light into the trees, but when I saw that there was nothing but shadows, I started to get this really bad feeling that something was wrong. I called out Mark's name again, louder that time, and that's what woke Joey. I heard rustling in his tent before he unzipped it, and I turned, trying not to blind him with the flashlight, and he just blinked up at me. His hair was a mess, and then he asked what was going on. We went through this whole back and forth of me telling Joey that I thought Mark was missing, him asking if Mark wasn't off taking a pee, and me assuring him that I wasn't just being a pansy. Then, once he was convinced something was wrong, Joey put his boots and jacket on and then climbed out of his tent. We went off searching in different directions at first, circling the campsite at a wider berth while calling out Mark's name, and my flashlight cut through the dark, picking out trunks and bushes, but no sign of Mark. When we met back at the campsite, Joey suggested Mark might have been sleepwalking. Apparently he'd done it a few times as a kid, and that one time, he made it all the way downstairs and into his backyard. I doubted it, but we widened the circle anyway, moving deeper into the woods. Only that time we agreed to stay together. As we walked further and further into the woods, the ground began to slope downward, with loose roots threatening to trip us up with each step into that darkness. And my feet and socks were already soaked, and the night was so chilly that my hands shook holding that flashlight. The forest felt even bigger now, denser and harder to navigate, but still we pushed on, yelling for Mark as we went. After about an hour of what felt like walking pretty much in circles, Joey suddenly stopped. He pointed his flashlight toward a bush and something gray that was snagged on it. I aimed my own light, and when I did, my heart sank. We each saw the unmistakable sight of Mark's hat, that faded blue one that he'd been wearing the whole trip, hanging from the bush's thorns. We stared at it for a second or two, not moving, and then Joey spoke up, saying it didn't make sense. We kept moving, each calling out Mark's name again, then about 50 feet onward, we found his socks, one, then the other, tossed aside like he just peeled them off and left them there. Next, we found his jeans crumpled in the dirt, and then his t-shirt, and then his boxers, all spread out over the course of maybe 50 to 60 yards and on a very deliberate path. Each of us started trying to make sense of what we were seeing, with Joey asking if I'd seen Mark drinking any liquor or using anything stronger. We drank all that beer that we had with us on that first night, but then, as much as I didn't like seeing him drinking any, there was no guarantee Mark hadn't been sneaky with a secret fifth of bourbon or something. But even if he had gotten drunk out of his mind in secret, He wasn't the kind of guy to go streaking through the woods in the middle of the night. And that just wasn't Mark's brand of humor, I guess. We went back and forth for like that, maybe for a few seconds. Carried on calling out Mark's name as loud as we could, and then I think maybe a minute or so later, we saw it. Just ahead of us, lying chest up on the ground, was the lifeless, decapitated body of a young man. Blood soaked the ground around it, having poured from the stump above his shoulders. The cut looked clean and straight, too. And the rest of the body looked untouched. No marks, no wounds, just pale, unblemished skin, bright white in the beams of our flashlight. And I think I kind of just shut down for a second or two. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. And it's weird to think about all these years later, but there was a moment where I thought to myself, is this even reality? I didn't think it was a dream, or that I might be hallucinating or anything like that. It just looked fake to me. I guess my brain refused to accept what I was seeing for a second and had me thinking it was some kind of movie prop, the way the bright white skin had this almost bluish tone to it, or the way all the blood had sort of congealed around the neck wound and made it look like plastic. I'd never seen a dead body before, so I guess I had no idea what to expect. But for the life of me, I didn't expect to see all of that. I guess Joey had a similar kind of reaction. He didn't think it was Mark, or at least he didn't want to think that it was Mark. And I'll never forget the deep feeling of hurt that I felt when instead of accepting it, Joey carried on calling out his name. Joey yelled louder and more frantic, over and over, pacing around that body but never looking at it. He kept saying it wasn't him, that it couldn't be. His voice kept cracking as he spoke. And I just stayed frozen. The flashlight I remember trembling in my hands as it slowly just sort of sank in for me. That was Mark. The height, the build, no tattoos or scars. It had to be him. And besides, all his clothes were lining the forest just a few yards away from us. My throat closed up as I tried to get the words out. In the end, I had to force them out, saying, Joey, it's him. It's Mark. He shook his head, saying no over and over. He still wouldn't look at the body. He just paced back and forth, hands on his head as the tears welled up in his eyes, and I said it again louder and angrier, my voice trembling, and he stopped yelling and then started just sobbing into his hands. My legs felt weak, but I couldn't sit. I did the only thing I could think of, which was walk over to Joey and try to console him. Once Joey's cries had quieted to just gasping, I held him while saying, "We gotta do something, man. I know it's messed up, but we gotta do something." Once he kinda calmed down enough to understand, we made our way back to camp as quickly as possible, even running at some points where the ground allowed us to. I don't know why we did that, looking back on it. Maybe it was just to feel like we were helping in some way, but by then, time wasn't an issue anymore. Our friend Mark was gone, and he was never coming back, no matter how fast we ran. Once we were back in my car, we took off along that road until we reached Middleton, and then after turning left towards Ranger HQ, there it was ahead of us. There were only two rangers manning the place since it was still before 6 a.m., but after we stumbled in, panicked, grief-stricken, they gave us some cups of coffee and let us tell our story. Joey did most of the talking, and his voice was an absolute mess, but I did my best to help him out whenever he stumbled over his words. They asked us questions we could hardly answer, and we gave up trying to explain and just begged to let us show them. The sun was coming up by the time we got back to our campsite, and everything looked just as it was when we left. And from there, we walked the accompanying ranger out to Mark's body, and when he saw it, all he could do was tighten his jaw. He then turned to us, narrowing his eyes, and asked what happened. I said we didn't know, and that we just found him like that. Joey nodded, and at that point his voice had gone hoarse. The ranger just stood around asking us a few more questions, but it slowly dawned on me that whatever we said, he was not buying it. He didn't act hostile in any way. There was no pushback at all, in fact, but something about the way he acted told me that he didn't believe us. He got on his radio and called it in. One body, decapitated, two witnesses. Then he told us that we weren't free to leave yet, and we were to wait back at our camp. EMTs eventually got there, and then the cops followed, and two cruisers with their lights flashing silently, I remember. They split us up, me by the tents and Joey near the pond, and then they started to question us. Where were we when it happened? What did we hear? Did Mark have any enemies that knew about this trip? Their questions came on thick and fast, but there was no sympathy or comfort issued. They thought we did it, and I could see it in how they treated us. After we were done talking, we were told that they'd have to bag everything up as evidence, and when I say they took everything, I mean they took everything. Our clothes, our gear, the cooler, both tents, all three sleeping bags, and the little knives that we'd use for cooking. We didn't object to any of it, and we knew that we'd done nothing wrong, and we just wanted to go home. Once the two cops had finished questioning me and Joey, they talked amongst themselves for a while and then told us that we better head to the station with them. We weren't under arrest, they just wanted to question us someplace that they could properly record it. Again, we hadn't done anything wrong, so we didn't object, and they drove us to the precinct before putting us in separate rooms. And those interrogation rooms were small and gray, with a metal table and a one-way mirror. A detective sat across from me with a notepad out, asking the same things the two uniformed cops did over and over, just in different variations. I told him everything that happened that night, from me waking up to seeing the flap was open, then the search, the clothes, and the body. When I finished, the detective leaned in and then asked if Mark and I had fought, or if I'd been jealous or angry with him for any reason. I said no, and it was a forceful one too. Me and Mark were friends, best friends. The detective didn't blink. He just wrote it down and then started off on the same old line of questioning. Where were we when it happened? What did we hear? And did Mark have any enemies that knew about our trip? A few hours later, they let both me and Joey go. He got pretty much the same hotbox treatment as I did, and by then, he'd also realized that the eye of suspicion was firmly upon us. We were scared, really scared, and each of us imagined some botched trial that'd see both of us wrongly convicted of first-degree murder. But even when faced with such a terrifying prospect, our fears were still dwarfed by the horror of what, in God's name, happened to our friend Mark. It still doesn't make any sense to me, even all these years later. If we'd come across him lying there, dead from a single gunshot or stabbed to death, but fully clothed, that would have been bad enough. But then, how'd he end up taking his clothes off like that? And who took his head? About a week after we were questioned, forensics came back clean. It was good news, but neither me nor Joey ever felt like celebrating it. There was still the matter of Mark's death, and more importantly, who the hell killed him? But after many, many months of obsessively investigating, the case eventually turned cold. The cops had no weapon, no motive, and there was another thing that stayed missing. Mark's head. Cops and rangers searched the area around the scene for days, hoping it'd turn up someplace, but it didn't. Whoever killed him had taken it with them. It all feels like a lifetime ago. Joey moved west about a year later, got a job out in Oregon someplace, and we don't talk a lot these days, but we do keep in touch. We just don't talk about what happened. I stayed around Cambridge, but I fell apart for a while. I couldn't hold down a job, even stuff like stocking shelves or driving delivery. I just blank out mid-shift, see Mark's body again and the blood soaking in the dirt, and then I just disappear from whatever I was doing and drink. Days were bad, but the nights were worse. On the off chance that I was sober when I fell asleep, I'd inevitably see Mark walking away from me through the woods, stripping as he went. I'd run after him, calling out his name, but he was never able to hear me. Then when he did finally turn around, he was headless. I'd wake up in a cold sweat with my heart pounding, wondering why I wasn't still back in that tent. Friends eventually drifted off, and my girlfriend too. She stuck around a year and then bailed when I couldn't open up about what had happened and my drinking problem. And I didn't blame her. I still don't. I was a complete mess. Drunk or sober, I'd sit in my apartment, lights off, staring at the wall. And then sometimes, if I had to go out, I'd drive past wooden spots and see the trees. And my grip would tighten around the steering wheel. Years later, I eventually hit rock bottom. I lost another job, stopped leaving the house, and stopped eating altogether, and then lost a bunch of weight. My sister dragged me to a doctor who put me on meds, and they dulled the edges, but the nightmares just didn't go away for a long, long time. She found this therapy program, cognitive behavioral, she said, a pretty intensive one too. And I started in the spring, twice a week. And those shrinks were good. They didn't push too hard, and one said writing something could help force me to face it instead of burying it. I could lay it all out, all the details, and maybe it'd lose some of its power over me. It worked better with time, just not by much. Mark is still gone. His case has stayed cold, and no one has ever found his head, who took it, or why. I don't go near that state forest anymore, or any wooded area at all for that matter. And while I'm better than I was, I'll never be the same person that I was before. The old me stayed out there in that forest, and in the exact spot that we found Mark's headless body. And just like my old high school buddy, he's never coming home. I've been looking forward to that camping trip for weeks. Myself, Craig, and Tanner, my buddies, had planned it out, nothing really fancy. It was really just supposed to be a night in the woods. We picked a spot in the middle of nowhere, out in Tennessee, somewhere deep in the backcountry where the trees were thick and the roads were complete dirt. And it was just us, our tent, some beers, and a fire. It was pretty simple, the kind of thing that we'd done 100 times growing up. I figured it would be a good time, and it was, until the morning. We got there late in the afternoon. The sun was already dropping down, and we set up camp quick, pitched the tent, gathered some wood, and got a fire going. The night was going smooth, and the woods were pretty quiet. We sat around, drinking and laughing, just sitting around the crackle of the fire, keeping us company. And it felt good to be out there, away from work and the noise of town. And when I woke up, the fire was just down to ashes, and the sky was gray, and then we could see that early morning light coming in. Craig and Tanner were still out cold, so I crawled out of the tent, stretched my legs, and then figured that I'd get some coffee going. I walked over to my truck to grab the pot from the back, and that's when I saw it. There was a skin, some kind of animal skin, stretched out across the hood of my truck. It wasn't just tossed there. It was laid out flat, like someone had taken their time spreading it. The fur was gone, scraped completely off, and the underside was raw and pink, just glistening and wet. Blood streaked down the windshield, thick and dark and already starting to dry at the edges. I couldn't tell what it was. Maybe a deer, maybe something smaller. The head was gone and the legs were cut off and jagged like they'd been hacked with a dull blade. And it stank. That sour, meaty smell that gets in your nose and just stays there. And all I could do was freeze, just staring at it as my hands started to get all shaky. I looked around, half expecting someone to be standing there watching me, but the woods were dead still. No birds, no wind, nothing. Just me and that thing on my truck. I kicked the tent to wake Craig and Tanner. They stumbled out groggy, but when they saw it, their faces went white. We didn't say much. We didn't need to. Something was clearly very wrong. We tore down camp fast, threw everything in the back of the truck without folding it up. I grabbed a stick and pushed that skin off the hood. It hit the ground with a wet slap, and I didn't look at it again. We piled in, and I floored it down the road, tires kicking up dust, and the whole way, I kept checking the rear view, like something might be chasing us. But there was nothing there, and I really couldn't shake that feeling, though. And we didn't talk about it much on the drive back. Craig kind of just stared out the window, and Tanner kept messing with his hands, picking at his nails, and I just focused on the road, trying to keep my mind blank and avoid whatever was back there. And when we got to town, we split up pretty quick. I went back home, washed the blood off of my truck with a hose, and stood there watching as the red kind of just swirled down the driveway. It really didn't feel real, but my gut wouldn't settle. And later that day, I started asking around to see if anyone knew anything. This guy, Mr. Harris, at the gas station gave me a look when I mentioned it, and he said that he'd heard stories of people finding skinned animals left in their cars or porches out in the deep woods, said that it had been happening off and on for years. No one knew who did it, but folks figured it was some type of warning, a message for outsiders or people who didn't belong. Harris said he'd seen it himself once, way back in the 80s when he'd camped too far out. He woke up to, I guess, a skinned rabbit on his cooler and apparently never went back again. I didn't sleep much that night, and I just kept picturing that skin, the way it was stretched out all careful, and I eventually got online and started digging. I found posts for people all over, all the same stories, these skinned animals left in the night, always in these remote spots. Some said it was hunters gone crazy or pranksters, and others thought it was something older, something tied to the land. One guy swore that he'd seen figures moving in the trees after it happened to him, but he didn't stick around to find out more. And the more I read, the worse it got. People talked about feeling watched, hearing noises after they got home, like whatever did it wasn't done with them. And I told myself it was nothing, just some sick joke, maybe kids messing around, but I really couldn't shake it. And I don't know who did it or what they wanted. Maybe we'd crossed some line, camped somewhere we shouldn't have. Maybe it was random. But I know it wasn't an animal that skinned that thing and put it on my truck. I haven't been camping since, and I don't think I ever will. Craig and Tanner pretty much feel the same way. We haven't really talked about it much, but it's there, pretty much looming over us. And I still drive that truck, but every time I look at the hood, I still see that skin. I keep the doors locked now, and I don't know if it'll ever stop. All I know is that I ain't going back in those deep woods ever again. I'd always been drawn to the outdoors, and my buddy Chris was the same. We'd been friends since we were kids, back when we'd skip class to mess around in the ravines near our neighborhood in Toronto, and over the years, that turned into a ritual. Every summer, we'd pick a spot, pack pretty light, and head out for a weekend of camping. Then, as time went by, we found that we had to raise the stakes to get that same old buzz. We coined the term hardcore camping, which I'm pretty sure is a case of parallel thinking rather than just us being original. But it basically involved no tents or stoves, just ponchos, ground sheets, and whatever we could carry on our backs. We'd bring a little food with us, but in such small amounts that after a couple of days, we'd have to forage and fish and otherwise live off the land if we wanted to eat. It wasn't easy, but that was the point. Then the year that we were both 24, we chose Algonquin Provincial Park, a massive chunk of forest and lakes up in Ontario, for 7 days of wilderness living. And we started out strong. The first day we hiked 12 miles from the trailhead, cutting through thickets of pine and birch, and the air was cool, the sky was patchy with clouds, and after our day's hike, we set up camp near a shallow creek. I rigged my poncho over a low branch while Chris gathered sticks for a fire, and then we ate some jerky, boiled some water from the creek, and let the flames of our campfire die down as the stars started to come out. It was quiet, just the rustling of leaves and the occasional hoot of an owl. But that was kind of how we liked it. No noise, no people, just us in the wild. Day two was a little tougher. The terrain got harder, all rocks and roots, and we had to climb a steep ridge to keep heading north. My calves were burning by midday, and the much taller Chris kept outpacing me as his long strides ate up the ground in front of him. And that night, we slept on a flat stretch of moss, and the ground was very cold, and I woke up once to the sound of a twig snapping, my hand fumbling for the knife that I kept at my side, but apparently it was just a deer moving through the dark. Now by day three, we were nicely warmed up and we fell into a steady rhythm. Our packs were lighter now, our food supplies were dwindling, but we were used to it, and hunger was always the best motivator to me. That afternoon, Chris caught a small trout in a stream with a line that he'd made out of something in a hook, and we cooked it over a fire, splitting that flaky meat with our own hands and drinking water that came from the fast-moving streams, and it was better than any bottled mineral water on the market at the time. We checked the map every now and then, but mostly we moved pretty much on instinct, letting the forest guide us to potential campsites. Algonquin was huge, thousands of square miles, and we were deep in the middle of it, far from any roads or ranger stations. But that's exactly why we were there, you know. No safety net, just us and the great green beyond. The fourth day started just like the others. Chris was already awake and rolling up his ground sheet as I climbed out of my tent. Then, we ate the last of our granola, shouldered our packs, and started up north again. The forest was dense, and we didn't talk much. We just fell into step, with our feet being pretty much the only sound we could hear. Now, around noon, we stopped at a narrow stream to refill our canteens. I knelt by the water, splashing some on my face, when Chris tapped my shoulder. "You see that?" he asked, pointing off into the distance. And I followed his eyes, and there it was. At first I couldn't see what he was pointing at, but then I saw it too. A shape, with too many straight lines to be natural. We grabbed our packs and moved closer, pushing through the underbrush. The trees started to part, and there it was. A building, or more specifically, a church. The walls were old wood, gray and cracked like they'd been standing for 100 years or more. The roof was steep, covered in moss and fallen needles, with a rusted cross perched at the top. Another cross hung from the front door, which was boarded up and chained shut with a heavy padlock. There was no steeple, no windows, just this worn, weathered box, half swallowed by the forest. I remember turning to Chris saying something like, "What the hell?" And he didn't answer. He just pulled out the map, spread it out on the ground, and began tracing our route with a single finger. And there was nothing where the church should have been. No marks, no symbols, no hint of anything man-made for miles in any direction. I remember saying how strange it was, seeing a church with no paths or roads leading to it, and far from any residential areas, too. Chris folded the map up. His eyes were now fixed on the building, and he said something like, "Let's check it out." We circled the structure, stepping over roots and ducking branches, and the chained-up door was the first thing that caught my eye. The rust was very thick, and the padlock seemed untouched. It looked like no one had been here in forever. Then as we got around the side, we saw a hole where the rotten wood had been scraped away. It was low and very jagged, just big enough for a person to crawl through. "It's got to be an animal," Chris said, peering into the dark. "Probably use this place as a den." And he was probably right. But when he shrugged off his pack and dropped down to his hands and knees, that's when I started to feel uneasy. I said something like, "Are you kidding, dude? You want to crawl inside?" And he says something like, "Duh. You don't want to see what's in there?" I mean, I did, but I figured we could just shine our flashlights inside and then take a look from outside the hole. And I suggested that, but Chris ignored me, just dropped to his stomach and started wiggling through that gap. I couldn't let him go inside alone, so, of course, I followed. I ditched my pack and followed him, the rough edges scraping my shoulders as I crawled through that hole in the wood, and the air inside that church was damp, cold, and stale. We stood up in the dim light, brushing dirt off of our pants, and the place was completely empty. No pews, nothing. Just bare walls and a floor of packed earth littered with dry leaves. At the far end stood a huge wooden cross, but what really stopped me was in the center of the room. A steel trap door, partially covered in dirt, and its edges bolted down and wrapped in thick chains. Another rusted padlock hung from the links, sealing it tight. I stepped closer, staring at that trap door. It looked solid. No scratches, no markings, just cold, dirty metal. Chris then walked over and knelt beside it, and the chains rattled as he gave them a tug. They were clearly solid. I remember wondering out loud what might necessitate something like chains, and Chris looked up. "Maybe it's not a church anymore," he said. "Maybe it's some kind of hideout." Now that much was obvious, but for what? And who? Chris stood up wiping his hands and said it could be anything. Cash, maybe, some smuggler's stash, or loot from a robbery, locked up and forgotten. I mean, why else would it be chained up like that? And I just shook my head. A bunch of cash seemed like a stretch, and it could just as easily be something dangerous. Nuclear waste, chemicals, something toxic people didn't want found. I think I made a pretty good point, but Chris just wasn't hearing me out. His eyes had this sort of edge to it, like he'd already decided what he was going to do. "We gotta get in there, man," he said, heading for the hole and the woods outside. "Let's find something to break the chains." I yelled for him to wait and then grabbed his arm, but he yanked free and crawled out anyways, and I just scrambled after him. Now outside, Chris started pacing around the church, kicking at the ground. I asked what he was doing, even though I already knew and got the exact answer I expected.
"I told you. I'm looking for a rock," he said. "Something heavy enough to smash that lock."
But the forest floor was flat there, just needles and small stones and nothing big enough for what he needed. I said he was acting stupid, that even if something was down there, it was a crazy idea to try and go get it. I told him that if he was right and there was cash or jewels locked away in there, they might belong to some gang member, in which case stealing from someone like that would be like signing our own death warrants. Again, I thought I made a pretty good point, but it was like Chris couldn't hear me, and I'd never seen him like that before. He was a spontaneous kind of guy, but he wasn't stupid. I asked him to stop, but again, he just ignored me.
"I'll hike till I find something,"
he shouted, striding off into the trees.
"I don't care how long it takes."
And that's when I snapped. I ran after him, grabbed his shoulder and spun him around, and I asked him what the hell had gotten into him. And he shoved me back, and then we started wrestling. He might have been taller, but Chris, he was much skinnier, and it was hard work, but I had to shove him against a tree before anyone got hurt. I yelled at him to stop again, to just effing stop. And then suddenly, it was like he could hear me again. It was like he came to. He froze and then let go of me, and I stumbled back. Both of us were breathing heavily from kind of tussling for a bit there, and I asked again what the hell had gotten into him. And he looked up, and his face at this point was pale and sweaty, and he said he didn't know. And I was just like, "Talk to me, man. What's going through your head right now? You didn't eat?" Chris repeated that he didn't know, and then after a second said that he couldn't stop thinking about that trap door, what might be down there, and that he felt like he needed to know. It was the adventure he was looking for. He looked kind of distant as he spoke too, rubbing his temples like he had some type of headache. And I crouched beside him, feeling the adrenaline fade as I asked if he was good to keep moving. He nodded, and we just went back to grab our packs, and then we put that weird church behind us. And the rest of the trip, though, felt kind of off. We camped two more nights and stuck to our routine, hiking, foraging, boiling water, but that spark and excitement for being out there was clearly gone. I kept watching Chris, waiting for that weird energy to reappear, but thankfully it didn't. He was a little quiet, but otherwise back to normal. And by the time we hiked out and drove back to Toronto, he was cracking jokes again like nothing weird had even happened. We started calling that church the Cellar Stash, turning it into some story that we'd laugh about over beers. But whenever I thought about it alone, it never felt all that funny to me. And back home, life slipped back to normal. I went back to my boring office job. Chris went back to working in kitchens, and we'd still meet up for drinks to plan our next camping trip. And whenever we did, the subject of the church would always come up, but it was always light and there was always a punchline. I'd ask him if he remembered losing it over that trap door, and he'd just kind of grin, shaking his head and say something like, "Of course I do. We'd be millionaires right now if it wasn't for you." We'd laugh and then change the subject, but neither of us ever suggested going back. In fact, we steered clear of that part of Algonquin altogether from there on out. It's kind of ironic, given how it was Chris that had seemed so suddenly and unexplainably obsessed with it. And not for me, but over time I realized that I couldn't get that church or the trapdoor out of my head. I just kind of lie awake some nights, picturing it. The gray door, the rusted crosses, the trapdoor sealed with its chains and padlocks. Chris's theories were wild. Cash, jewels, but I wasn't buying it. Something about the place felt wrong, like it was something way more sinister than some crook's secret stash. I'd think about how Chris acted, how he had that manic edge in his eyes that I'd never seen before, and wondered if it was just him or if it was something in the church or us hiking. I don't know. It did something to him, though. And then the months passed, and then a year, and Chris never showed another sign of cracking, and to this day, he's been solid as a rock. We went on other trips, smaller ones, closer to home, and there was like a sort of unspoken agreement that Algonquin was off the table. I'd scroll through forums sometimes, looking for anything about a church in the park, but nothing seemed to match, no records or stories, and it was almost like that place didn't actually exist. And maybe it didn't, not officially anyway. Maybe someone built it out there, away from everything for a reason we'd really never know about, long, long ago. And I'd tell myself it was just an old ruin, a relic of some forgotten time, and that me and Chris had just overreacted. But then I remembered the chains and the way that they'd sort of gleamed in the light and the hairs in the back of my neck standing up. Chris moved on, or at least he seemed to. He'd talk about the trip like it was nothing, like the church was just a weird blip. I played along and kept it light, but deep down, I knew that we brushed up against something that we weren't meant to find. I never told him how much it still bothered me, how I dreamed about that trapdoor some nights, and how I sometimes wondered if we dodged something worse than we realized. And it's been years now, and we are still friends. He's the same Chris, loud, stubborn, and loyal, and I don't think he dwells on it too much, but me? I don't think I'll ever fully let it go, hence why I sent it here. And that church, I know it's still out there. I'm sure of it. Standing silent among those trees and whatever's chained up under that trap door, I sincerely hope it stays there. We went on a camping trip to Harriman State Park. It was me, Simon, and Eddie, just the three of us, looking to get away from the city for a weekend. We planned it for weeks, packed our gear, and drove up from Brooklyn on a Friday afternoon. And the park was quiet when we got there, and we set up camp near one of the smaller lakes, a spot that we'd picked off of a map because it was far from the main trails. By the time we had the tent set up and a fire going, it was already getting dark, but the first night was awesome. We had hot dogs, a few beers, and the first serious catch-up in months. And the next day, we decided to hit the trails. It was late morning, and we didn't have any kind of plan. We just followed a trail until it kind of petered out and then kept going anyway. My buddy Eddie had his phone out, snapping pictures of mushrooms and random rocks, while Simon kept talking about finding a good spot for lunch. I was just along for the walk, half listening to them argue about whether there were Bigfoots in New York, and after a couple of hours, the trees started thinning out and we came up on a small lake that we hadn't seen on the map. It was small, less than 100 yards across, and right there near the shore was this lone wooden shack. It wasn't much to look at. The wood was this sort of weathered grayish-brown type and splintered in various places like it had been sitting there for decades at this point. The roof kind of sagged a little, and there was no glass in the single window, just a square hole with a torn scrap of curtain hanging inside. The door was left ajar, not locked, just creaking on its hinges when the wind pushed against it. Simon said it looked abandoned, and Eddie agreed, but I wasn't so sure. Something about it felt off, but we were curious, so we went closer. Inside, it was pretty dim. The light from the window barely reached the corners, and the air just smelled musty, like old wet dirt and old wood. There wasn't much in there. A wooden table in the middle, a couple of broken chairs tipped over in the corner, and some rusty nails sticking out of the walls. And the table caught my eye first. It was rough, splintered, and covered in some dark stains. These sort of big, uneven patches that looked almost black in the shadows. And I ran my fingers over one, but I couldn't tell what it was. Eddie said it was probably bloodstains. Simon agreed, pointing at the walls. They were lined with hooks. Maybe a dozen of them, screwed into the boards at different heights. Some were bent, others rusted, but they were empty. No tools, no ropes, nothing hanging there now. And it made sense to think a hunter had used this place, maybe to skin deer or whatever else he'd shot. And that's what we told ourselves anyway. It was creepy, but I suppose not unexplainable. And we continued poking around for a few minutes. Simon kicked at the curtains, and Eddie took a picture of the table, saying he'd show it to his brother who hunted upstate, and I just stood by the door, pretty much ready to leave. To me, that shack did not feel right, and then when we stepped outside, I was glad to be breathing lake air again. We started walking back toward the trail, figuring that we'd head to camp and eat, and it was around about then that Simon tripped. He was a few steps ahead of me, near the side of the shack, when his foot caught on something. He stumbled, his arms went flailing, but didn't fall. Eddie and I caught up, and there it was. Something metal sticking out of the dirt, just an inch or two above the ground. It was dull, rusted in certain spots, and half covered in soil. And at first I thought it was a knife or maybe a hatchet, something a hunter might have dropped and forgotten. Simon crouched down and brushed some dirt off of it, but it didn't budge. He said that it was stuck. Eddie handed me his water bottle and told us to dig it up. I grabbed a stick and started scraping at the dirt, and Simon used his hands, pulling up clumps of earth and just tossing it aside, and the more we dug, the bigger things got. It wasn't a tool, that much was there. There was a curved edge, and then another, and soon we could see it was hollow inside. And after 10 minutes, we had it mostly uncovered. It was a helmet, or at least something that looked like one. The metal was heavy, maybe iron, pitted and rusted, but solid. It was tall, pointed at the top like a pyramid, and the front had two slits for eyes shaped like crosses. Not the kind of crosses that you might see at a church. They were sharper, uneven, like someone had hacked them in with a chisel. And the whole thing was strange. It definitely didn't belong here, and it creeped me out just looking at it. Eddie steps back, asking what it was, and Simon picked it up, actually grunting at how much it weighed, and held it out in front of him, saying something like, looks like a clan hood or something, he said, but metal. And I didn't think it was that. The clan didn't wear iron pyramids on their heads, and as far as I knew, it felt older and heavier, like it wasn't meant just for show. Simon turned it over, looking inside, and he said it smelled like rust and mud, and then smiled and said, I'm going to put it on. No, you're not, Eddie said, snatching it from him. And he set it on the ground and wiped his hand on his jeans. It's filthy. At least clean it first. Simon shrugged, but I could tell that he was serious about trying it on later. But I didn't like it. The helmet gave me a bad feeling, like it was almost watching us through those cross slits. But I didn't say anything. I didn't want to sound paranoid like I've been listening to your channel for so long. And we left it there by the shack and headed back to camp. The hike back was pretty quiet, though. None of us talked much, and we just kind of kept our eyes on the trail. And by the time we got to the tents, the sun was starting to go down low. We built a fire, cooked some pasta on the camp stove, and sat around eating it with some jarred sauce on top. We talked, and before long, that helmet came up again. Eddie said it was probably some art project, maybe a prop from a movie shoot that got left behind. Simon, though, he didn't buy it. It's too heavy for that, he said. Why bury it? And I didn't have an answer. I just kept thinking about those stains on the table and the hooks on the walls. The shack didn't feel like some hunter's place anymore. Not with that thing outside. But we let it drop and finished eating and stayed by the fire until it burned down to just embers. It was after sundown, maybe about 9 or 10, when Simon got up. The sky was dark and there was no moon, just stars and the faint glow of the coals. And he didn't say anything, just grabbed his flashlight and started walking off into the trees.
"Hey, where are you going?"
I called after him. He didn't answer though and just kept going. Eddie and I looked at each other.
"He's getting the helmet,"
he said, and I nodded. We could have stopped him, but we didn't. Simon was gone for a while, longer than it should have taken to walk to the shack and back. Eddie started pacing, muttering about how stupid he was for walking off on his own like that, and I just sat by the fire, poking at it with a stick, trying not to think about that helmet sitting out there in the dark. When Simon finally came back, he was empty-handed. He looked pale and he wouldn't look at us. Eddie asked what happened. Simon sat down on a log and just stared at the ground.
"I threw it," he said, "out in the woods somewhere. Didn't want it looking at me."
Eddie asked what he meant by looking at him, and Simon didn't answer. He just shook his head. And Eddie continued to press him, but Simon wouldn't say any more. He looked shaken, like he'd seen something he couldn't explain. And we didn't push any harder than that, and the fire was already dying, and none of us wanted to stay up much longer. We climbed into the tent, zipped it shut, and tried to go to sleep, and I just laid there for a while listening to the wind and Simon's uneven breathing. I kept picturing that helmet, though, those cross slits starting out from wherever he tossed it, and wondered what kind of person would make a thing like that. And the next morning, we packed up early. No one said it, but we all wanted out of there. The drive back was quiet, just the hum of the engine and the occasional car passing us on the highway. We didn't talk about the shack or the helmet, not then and not later, but it stayed with me. Sometimes I'd catch myself wondering what it was, where it came from. I'd think about that shack and the stains and the hooks and that thing buried in the dirt. It didn't feel like some hunter's tool or some lost prop. It felt like something darker, something that none of us were supposed to find. And years later, I looked up Harriman State Park online, trying to see if anyone else had come across that shack. I didn't find much, just trail maps and reviews from hikers. Nothing about a lake with a shack or a buried helmet. Maybe we'd wandered further off the path than we thought, and maybe it's still out there, rustling in the woods where Simon tossed it. I don't know. I haven't been back, and I really don't plan to. And whatever it was, I'm glad we left it behind, but sometimes, late at night, I still see those cross slits in my head, and I wondered if we walked away from something worse than we'll ever understand. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my email at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, Tough Titty said the kitty when the milk ran dry.